Welcome back to Quick Bits. As I prepare to cover the Karen Reed trial, which is starting on Monday, April 29th, the day this goes live, Quick Bits is going to be the way I keep you in the loop on everything else that's happening in the law. So make sure that you are subscribed to the podcast on your audio only and that you are subscribed to the YouTube Quick Bits channel so that you can stay in the loop while trial coverage keeps the live streaming channel full of nothing but trial coverage. Also, one last plug. No, first plug for the Law Nerd app at lawnerdapp.com, which is where I'm going to keep you in the loop of when we are streaming trial, if we need to add in extra streams, changes in schedules, breaking things that are happening in the cases I'm covering. All of that is in the app. But let's get into what we need to cover today, which is the Karen Reed trial starting, Harvey Weinstein's conviction in New York getting overturned, and what it means going forward. Everything that's popping off in the Rust case, including tons and tons and tons of lawyer sass. The Idaho surveys are continuing, and the case I covered in the podcast last week. Let's go.
I'm legal analyst Emily D. Baker. This is the Quick Bits, where I break down just the main points of the pop culture and entertainment cases I'm currently covering on YouTube and the Emily Show podcast. Let's get into it.
First, yes, the Karen Reed trial is finally starting in Massachusetts. It seems like it took quite a long time for a jury to be selected, but the jury selection wasn't all of what was holding things up. There were a lot of motions and legal housekeeping going on with the lawyers. The case is finally starting in a smaller courtroom than it had been in because of a last-minute motion from the defense that said basically the back nine jurors were only seeing the back of a witness's head. I don't know how you determine somebody's credibility without being able to look at them while they're speaking, or even just being able to pay attention to a long trial when all you're seeing is the back of someone's head for 8 weeks of trial, which is what the estimate of this trial is now. So that is going to be going on day in and day out, and I'll be covering it gavel to gavel over on the Emily D. Baker channel, which is my live stream channel. All right, we need to talk about a conviction that's been overturned and what that means. I broke down the Court of Appeals in New York ruling overturning the conviction of Harvey Weinstein and ordering a new trial. Yes, it is unusual that an appeal is successful. It is unusual that a conviction gets overturned. In this case, it is because of prior bad acts evidence. I'm going to explain what that means and answer a lot of the questions I've seen in the comments about what this means for his California convictions. Yes, his California convictions still stand. Yes, they are being appealed. Weinstein was convicted in New York in 2020 and subsequently sentenced to 23 years. He was then convicted in California after a retrial and sentenced to 16 years there. So that means if he was in custody in New York, which it seems that he was, he will be transported to California to start prison time in California. But it seems that there have been some health concerns and his transport has been slowed down a bit. But no, he is not being released from custody based on this ruling. The Court of Appeals in New York found that the prior bad acts evidence admitted in New York ran afoul of their law. Prior bad acts evidence, sometimes called 404B evidence, is evidence that shows improperly that because a person did a thing in the past, they're more likely to do a thing now. You'll hear it referred to as propensity evidence. They have a propensity to do the thing that they did before. That is not evidence of charged acts. It is not the evidence that someone is on trial for. It is evidence outside of what the trial is for. And there are exceptions in the rules of evidence to allow that in. And the court found that there was no valid exception to allow this evidence in and made very clear that the victim testimony should have stood on its own. That, you know, in these sexual assault charges, all of the victims testify that there was no consent. All of that testimony was clear. The additional bad acts evidence from not the charged victims in the case, but other complaining witnesses who allege prior instances with Weinstein, they're saying that the victim testimony should have stood on its own and that prior testimony was not needed to show intent, plan, motive, etc. It was only admitted for the improper purpose of showing a propensity to behave consistent with the prior bad acts. In California, the law is different. There is a code in the evidence, 1108, that in sexual assault cases allows for prior uncharged acts to come in through witness testimony. So in California, this isn't going to be a problem. New York does not have a law like that. New York does not have a code section like that. So in New York, the admitted prior bad acts, witnesses, and evidence, the court found runs afoul of the case law and the rules of evidence in New York. Can New York change their rules to mirror California's? Yes, they can. That would have to happen through their lawmakers. But because the laws are so different in New York and California, the appeal in New York isn't going to upend or doesn't signal any issues for the conviction in California. And remember, as we're talking about Karen Reed, Weinstein's defense attorney in Los Angeles is the same defense attorney that is representing Karen Reed, Alan Jackson. So when we previously talked about the Weinstein case and statements that were made at sentencing or closing argument, it was with the same lawyer that is representing Karen Reed in Massachusetts now. There were a lot of questions about this. I did break down that ruling more thoroughly on my live stream, but in short, he is not getting released from prison. His California convictions are being appealed, but they are in a much different legal position than the New York appeals were. When cases get appealed, jury instructions are generally the number one thing that can get a case overturned. But prior bad acts evidence is like number 1.5. It's not even number two. I talked about this a lot during the trial of Alec Murdaugh when they were admitting quite a lot of prior bad acts evidence. Different in that case, Murdaugh admitted to a lot of the financial crimes. Weinstein maintained his innocence about the prior bad acts evidence that was admitted at his trial. The Court of Appeal views that as stacking the deck improperly against a defendant. And in the app, I linked the full decision if you want to read it for yourself, and you can go to my more thorough discussion of it on the live stream. But I hope that answers the questions you have about why the Court of Appeal did this and what happens next. At the end of the day, prosecutors in New York can choose to retry Weinstein. And based on the statements made by the appeals court that the victim testimony can and should stand on its own, if I were prosecutors, if the victims wanted to go through a retrial, I would strongly consider it based on the fact that the Court of Appeals only took issue with that 404B bad acts evidence, and that can easily not be admitted at the next trial and allow the victim testimony to stand on its own. Next, we need to talk about Rust. And in the Rust case, a lot is going on, including Alec Baldwin's lawyers firing back at the prosecutors. You'll remember that right now they are arguing over whether or not the indictment of Alec Baldwin should be dismissed. The defense arguing that the prosecutors in the indictment acted in bad faith, and therefore the court is allowed to consider whether this indictment should stand. And after you get past that first hurdle, then they're asking the court to consider the type of evidence presented, whether the prosecution met their burden of presenting the grand jury in a unbiased way, whether they presented the proper exculpatory evidence, whether they made evidence available, and whether or not they gave the grand jury an improper jury instruction in violation of the court's prior order with regard to the jury instructions at the grand jury. The defense filed that motion. It was with exhibits, that motion was hundreds of pages long. The prosecution fired back and spent half the motion clarifying where the defense said that they acted badly, and including little throwaway lines like Mr. Baldwin is not being prosecuted because of his impressive ego, but because of his actions on the set of Rust. And so it's no surprise that when the defense filed their reply to the state's opposition, they started out with all guns blazing, saying, quote, "When the debate is lost, slander becomes the tool of the loser, anonymous." They included a quote above the introduction segment of their filing, which is something we don't often see. They also say, quote, "Alec Baldwin's motion to dismiss raises serious legal issues, makes serious legal arguments that are supported by binding legal precedents, and carries serious legal consequences, not only for Alec Baldwin, but all New Mexico citizens. The motion, therefore, deserves a serious response addressing Baldwin's arguments about the state's misconduct in the grand jury proceeding, Instead, the state responded with a 32-page jeremiad against Baldwin and his lawyers that does not cite a, and this is in italics, single legal decision, does not distinguish Baldwin's authorities, and spends no more than 5 pages addressing the core legal issues raised by Baldwin's motion. This fact bears repeating. Colon. The state does not cite a single legal decision in its entire brief. Literally. That's not me giving commentary. The motion says literally. Also, yes, when I covered this on live stream, I had to look up what jeremiad meant and how to pronounce it, though the live stream chat immediately said, excuse me, Jeremiah was a bullfrog. He's a very good friend of mine, to which I say 10 out of 10 Lawnards, the chat is always bae. And no, don't think I was going to leave you hanging. Jeremiad is a, quote, long, mournful complaint or lamentation, a list of woes, and the international Lawnards have let me know that this is derived from French and is frequently used there to mean basically cry harder. So, or cry more. So thank you again to the Lawnards, but Baldwin's lawyers are not thrilled, but that's not where the Rust drama stops. The prosecution also filed a flurry of information on Friday, including a subpoena for documents to Jason Bowles, Hannah Gutierrez's lawyer, asking him for, quote, all documentation regarding communications between any employee or contract employee or agent of the Bowles Law Firm and Alexander Ray Baldwin, any attorneys or other employees of Quinn Emanuel Law Firm, any attorneys acting on behalf of Baldwin, any representatives of Baldwin or Baldwin's counsel. This document includes, but is not limited to, any notes, messages, emails, text messages, recordings, or any other forms of correspondence. I want to know what the prosecution thinks Baldwin or his team are talking to Hannah's lawyers about and why they think they're entitled to that information, because I would sure love to know. They also amended their witness list for trial, and the court signed an order granting the withdrawal of Jason Lewis as special prosecutor. So we are back down to 2 special prosecutors. And Carrie Morrissey gave a statement to People indicating that this was simply a scheduling issue because of when the trial is set for Alec Baldwin and that Jason Lewis is still maintaining his own practice and has conflicts between his duties as a special prosecutor and his own clients. The state also filed, I told you it was a lot, a leave to file a surreply. The state, and I have not covered this on stream and I'm not going to have time to, which is why I love the quick bits. This is where I'm going to keep you up to date while we are covering the Karen Reed trial between this and the podcast, which means that, Emily, it means the quick bits aren't going to be so quick. The state also filed a motion asking the court for leave to file a surreply. The state said that they need to respond to the defense's reply because, quote, it is critical that the court have all factual information and legal arguments before it to decide a dispositive motion on a case involving death. They say that Baldwin's counsel's position asserted via email is that the state's arguments have been waived and or must be reserved for oral argument. And they say that that is simply the defense's attempt to withhold pertinent information that would aid the court in a full analysis of the facts and law as they pertain to the defendant's motion to dismiss. The state then goes on to say that in the interest of justice, they must file a surreply no more than 10 pages in length to be filed within 2 hours of the issuance of the court's order authorizing it, meaning the state has already written it. And they said that they sent that to defense counsel. It is not often that there is a surreply. Generally, motions are the moving party makes a motion and asks for something. The other party opposes the motion. Then the moving party replies to that opposition and kind of closes the loop. And then the court hears argument or the court rules on the papers. Well, the prosecution is saying, but wait, Your Honor, there's more. This is probably because the defense said, well, they didn't even make any legal arguments, so all of their arguments are waived. Well, not shockingly, the defense then filed an opposition to the state's request for leave to file a surreply, saying that motions are typically resolved through a 4-part process. moving papers, opposition, reply, argument. They say that the state has already had a full opportunity to oppose the motion, and that bringing up any other arguments would essentially allow the state another bite at the apple that they do not get. They said, additionally, the state got an extra week to respond. The state exceeded the court's set limits for filings, and they didn't object. So the state had a full and fair opportunity to argue this. And then they say, quote, the state now wants a mulligan. For those of you that are under the age of, 30, that means do-over. It wants another chance to make arguments it declined to make and present new information it wishes it had previously included, all while having the last word, so Baldwin has no written opportunity to demonstrate once again that the state's assertions are legally and factually meritless. They go on to say that the state has not demonstrated any special reason the court should grant the state another bite at the apple. The state argues, for example, that Baldwin has, quote, taken advantage of the court's permission to exceed page limits and asked to submit minimal supplemental briefing to address Baldwin's, quote, new exhibits and, quote, intentionally misleading statements of law. They say that the state's argument should be rejected. And then they go on for another like two pages arguing that. So we're not even at the end of briefing yet on this motion to dismiss the indictment. We are at the very end of April. I don't even know how that happened. And this is scheduled for the beginning of July. So these motions are invariably going to take place while the Karen Reed trial is going on. And I will cover them the best that I can and keep you in the loop on how I'm going to do that. Guess where? You know where. On the app. Let's talk about Idaho. The court finally issued their order with regard to the Koberger potential juror questionnaires that they are using in support of their motion for change of venue. What the court essentially said was that the matters of public record are only things that are in the public court record, not what is known to the public, not what is in the media, but things in just the court record. And then the court went on to maybe a little snarkily say, and because the prosecution let the shit out of the horse in the public hearing on this issue, all the questions in the questionnaire are now part of the public record. So there is no reason to preclude the defense from sallying forth with their questionnaire. The court also alluded to the fact that some of the questions might have run afoul of the non-dissemination order because they were not in the public record, including questions about stalking or following victims on social media. But because of the court hearing and because the prosecution read them into the record, they are now in the public record. So there is no reason to prevent the defense from continuing to ask those questions. So the questionnaires will continue. And the court has set the defendant's motion for change of venue hearing on June 27th at 10 a.m. Pacific time in Idaho, which will be streamed. They also set all the deadlines for the briefing on this. The briefing from the defense will be the results of all of the surveys that they have been compiling to show that the case needs to be moved out of Latah County and make their argument of where to move it. Will we be surprised if that's where Boise is? No, not at all. Do I expect much more to happen in Idaho between now and then? No. And finally, on the podcast this week, I talked about the case of the Kansas missing moms. It is an Oklahoma double homicide prosecution. Four had been arrested and were being held without bail at the time that I recorded the podcast. After the podcast went live, a fifth defendant was arrested and held for the same charges as all of the other defendants. Two counts of first-degree murder, two counts of kidnapping, and one count of conspiracy to commit murder. That fifth defendant is Paul Grice, who had been mentioned in the affidavits, but just had not been arrested yet. I'm sure there will be more information forthcoming on that. If you did not listen to the podcast, this is a case of a woman who is locked in a custody dispute with the father of her children. It is alleged by law enforcement that the paternal grandmother organized the murder of the mother of the children, Veronica Butler, which would be the defendant, Tiffany Adams's son's baby's mother. So Tiffany Adams has been arrested. Her significant other, Tad, has been arrested, and then three other associates of them have been arrested. According to law enforcement documents, Tiffany has confessed to organizing these murders. Witnesses gave quite a lot of information about them. The cell phone evidence is fairly strong. The witness evidence seems fairly strong. As we go through this case, the second victim, Jillian Kelly, was accompanying victim Veronica Butler to go pick up the children who are 6 and 8 to take them to a birthday party because Jillian was one of the court-ordered supervisors that would go with Veronica when she had time with her children. It was said to the media and to law enforcement by Veronica Butler's lawyer that at a hearing coming up later in the month of April, Veronica would likely have been granted more custody of the children and unsupervised custody of the children. Law enforcement said that defendant Tiffany Adams, the children's grandmother, said that Veronica would not be an issue much longer, in addition to making other statements like knowing the way that the judge walked to work and being able to take care of things that way. They also plotted to throw an anvil off of a vehicle at the victim Veronica's vehicle to make it look like an accident. The defendant Tiffany Adams and the four co-defendants are all also part of an organization that they call God's Misfits. So if you've heard of this case, you might hear of it referred to that way. I will not be referring to it that way just because it seems that a name they want to call themselves. And I'm not putting any respect on whatever they've named their group that decided to murder the mother of Tiffany Adams's grandchildren. Because the people that lose in all of this are the 6 and 8-year-old who have lost their mother, and their grandmother has now been charged with the murder and has reportedly confessed to that murder. It is a very sad case and a very stark reminder that custody battles can end horribly. It reminded me very much of following the Adelson case, where again, the children's grandmother is in custody pending trial for the murder of their father. This is not the way. And with all of that, there is much happening in the Britney Spears conservatorship that will be on the podcast this coming week. So make sure you tune into the Emily Show on Wednesday before court, but live court coverage starts on Monday, and I can't wait to see you back in court. Look, you guys, I'm ready. I'm ready for court. You guys, Monday.
Bring the jury.
I'm so ready. So I will see you in court on Monday. And with that, Lawnards, thank you for being here. This has been a little bit of a XL quick bits, but that's what's going to happen over the next few weeks. I'll see you in the next one.
You can stay up to date with everything I'm covering on our free iOS and Android app at lawnerdapp.com or search your app store for Law Nerd. And you can also follow me on social media at The Emily D. Baker. Remember, I stream on YouTube on Tuesdays and Thursdays. I recap all of that for you in quick bits on Monday. And of course, The Emily Show drops on Wednesdays. Thanks for being a Law Nerd.